Okay, welcome back to another episode of More From Sam. We are taping this episode live in front of subscribers. They've submitted questions in advance of the show, and then we've asked them to provide any follow-ups by using the chat feature so that we can try to address their feedback in real time. Another thing to add, the questions for this episode are outstanding. I love being reminded that so many in this audience are so thoughtful and smart with different voices from many parts of the world, and I just want to thank everyone for taking the time to submit the questions. There's really great stuff in here, so I'm excited for today's episode.
I haven't seen any of these questions, by the way.
No, you have not.
I'm as excited as everybody else.
Yeah. This is a good one. This is going to be a good episode. We'll try to get to as many as we can, and we'll get to those in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor. Next week, Sam has shows in Portland and Vancouver, March 11th in Portland, March 12th in Vancouver. There are still some tickets available for those shows, as well as for the shows we have on sale in May. Toronto's already sold out, but you can find info for how to get tickets at samharris.org for the other shows I just mentioned, as well as DC, New York City, Austin, and Dallas. Okay, on to our first topic. Sam, should the U.S. have taken military action against Iran?
Yeah, well, I think you have to hold two thoughts in your head simultaneously to have an adequate answer to this question. So the first thought is that at any point since 1979, it would have been a good thing to unseat the regime in Iran. It would have been true when they took our hostages. It would have been true in 1983 when they engineered the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. It would have been true during the Iraq War, whatever you think about that war, given that they were producing all the IEDs that were killing our soldiers. It would have been true at every in 1989 with the Salman Rushdie fatwa. Right? I mean, this is an engine of terrorism and just awfulness for the world, right? For open societies everywhere. And to say nothing of the immiseration of the Iranian people. And I think it's a scandal of the Obama administration and the Biden administration not to have done more to support the Iranians who risked their lives to fight for the civil rights of women in particular at various moments during those administrations. I just think we have strangely been deterred by Iran for a generation and a half, right? We've been scared to tangle with Iran because it is a proper jihadist regime run by true religious fanatics that show a bottomless appetite for making life miserable in open societies wherever they can do it directly or through their proxies, right? So that's all true. And yet, here's the second thought. It's also true that the Trump administration is the most corrupt and incompetent administration I think we've ever had. And we are right to worry that Trump and his enablers and, you know, the rest of his administration, people like Hegseth, don't have any real purchase on a sane, you know, philanthropic, you know, humanitarian impulse. I mean, they whatever they might say about caring about the Iranian people, we're right to worry that doesn't run very deep. I think Trump is totally capable of breaking everything over there and then just turning around and saying, well, this is victory. You know, it's on the Iranian people now, and we're done. I think he could do that in a way that no other U.S. president really could with a clear conscience, right? So next week, he could declare victory and leave Iran in total chaos, right? So I don't know what to expect from this war. I certainly hope it goes well. I hope what happens is there's a proper regime change and the Iranian people get to express their desire for something like a secular democracy, a desire which I think many of them, probably a majority of them, actually have. I think Iran was always a much better candidate for regime change and nation building than Iraq and certainly Afghanistan ever were. So I think we have drawn the wrong lessons from our misadventures in Afghanistan and Iraq if we think that Iran was just a hopeless case and, you know, we should never have meddled there. But I think it's totally rational to worry that Trump will do this badly. The communication has been just appalling around this. I mean, he's done nothing to prepare the American people for this. We have no allies other than Israel. Congress has been sidelined, as they have been in everything. So this is a constitutional problem. So it's all kinds of bad in terms of how this has been done, and yet that doesn't mean it will necessarily fail. And I certainly hope it doesn't fail. So if you can reconcile those two thoughts that may seem contradictory, that's my view of it.
A follow-up question. I don't need to do the whole part. I can just begin with it. I'm wondering if Sam has any regrets about his hawkish stance, possibly giving the U.S. administration coverage for what looks to be naked aggression without a plan, essentially that. Do you have any regrets about taking your hawkish stance?
Yeah.
On giving the U.S. administration coverage, you know, for feeling supportive for what's happening in Iran right now.
Well, no, I mean, everything I said around that first thought is true. It's just what I believe now. It's what I believed before this war started. It's what I will believe, really, whatever happens here, because I think it is just, in fact, true that if you look back at the protests, you know, the Iranian women some years ago, you know, crying out for their civil rights and, you know, risking torture and death, you know, merely to, you know, take off their hijabs in public. If you care about women's rights, if you care about human rights, you should care about those women, right? And it's just, it's completely intolerable that we have acquiesced to this meme that it is somehow a sign of bigotry to express how evil it is that under this version of Islam, women are subjected to what is in reality gender apartheid. I mean, it's just, and obviously this is not the only concern I have with the Iranian regime, but that concern alone should have led to much greater support from us. There is no outcome other than regime change that would have in reality ever been acceptable here with respect to Iran. Iran can never have a nuclear weapon because it's a jihadist regime. And I can make the generic case. We are perpetually at war with jihadism, whether we want to state it that way or not. And Iran, almost uniquely, was a proper jihadist regime that was within reach of developing nuclear weapons. And so it's just, there's no world in which we can negotiate with a regime like that, even though we can pretend to, as the Obama and Biden administrations did, and as Trump may yet pretend to. I mean, that's the other thing that we have to realize, is that Trump may decide that he's going to try to create some Venezuela-like endgame here, where he's just going to install somebody who will claim to be pliant, but in this case really can't be, because all of the people who would follow from, you know, the ranks of the, you know, surviving mullahs in Iran are in fact religious maniacs, right? I mean, it's a very different situation than Venezuela. So I think it's just an absolute mirage to think that we could ever have negotiated any sort of proper peace with Iran, given the actual religious commitments of the regime. And that's a fairly unique case. I would not say the same thing of Saudi Arabia or many of these other Muslim states. I wouldn't say the same thing of Pakistan in its current form, and Pakistan has nukes. But if Pakistan ever got taken over by a real jihadist regime, we would have a full-on emergency with Pakistan, right? So the nukes and jihadism just do not play well together, and we can never lose sight of that. And we were on the verge of losing sight of that with respect to Iran, but I don't think I gave anyone cover for anything. I just think this is just true. And yet it's also true that the way Trump has done this is authoritarian, right? This is not the way a U.S. president should take our country into war, without explaining anything, without consulting anyone, with having cartoon characters, you know, running the effort. You just listen to Pete Hegseth talk about anything and you know you're not in good hands. So there's nothing optimal about this, but that also doesn't mean that the aftermath of this might not be better than what preceded it, because what preceded it was just about as bad as can be.
Yeah, so I was interpreting the question as, which you addressed, was being hawkish given this administration and the way that they might go about doing this
Right. In
all the wrong ways. Your comment on jihadism might answer this next question. Why isn't anyone calling out the Trump administration on the double standard of our enthusiastic military defense of the Iranian people and our lack of resolve to militarily defend the people of the democratic country of Ukraine?
Well, yeah, it is again, I think we've been bad on Ukraine too, right? I mean, it's understandable that we're not enthusiastic about stumbling into a direct conflict with Russia, right? So that, you know, the moment of nuclear blackmail, all of that was sobering for a reason. At this distance from, you know, the start of the war, I think it was a bluff that we essentially called, and it proved to be a bluff. I'm not actually worried about a nuclear war with Russia, really, over Ukraine. But yeah, I think we should have always given Ukraine more support, and Europe should have as well. And it's just, it's understandable. This war is awful, and we fought some bad ones, right? And we fought ones that in retrospect look totally pointless and horrible. So it's easy to see how we basically have a renewed version of Vietnam syndrome to some degree, which makes it impossible to notice necessary wars early, right? And I think we should have helped Ukraine earlier more than we did. And I don't know, it remains to be seen what's going to happen there. But.
Hi, Sam. Having watched Donald Trump and his court ride roughshod over every norm, convention, and more recently, international laws, are the rules of engagement around war, my question to you is, what is the point of any of them?
What's the point of any of what wars?
No. Of every norm, convention, and more recently, international laws. What are the point of any of these rules of engagement around war? What is the point of any of this stuff if the question is if Trump and his cohort just completely ignore it and go about it their own way?
Well, the point is we used to have a liberal international order that was anchored to our being a good and viable and respectable superpower, right? So that has changed radically, and we have alienated pretty much all of our allies except for Israel. I think that's, while there's a silver lining perhaps to some of it, the net result is quite bad, and I think we're going to discover what it's like to live in a world where our country stands for nothing other than its own power and its own interests, right? I mean, we're now a country that has declared to the world that we are fundamentally amoral, right? Like we're not going to judge anyone else for being imperialistic and, you know, savage on the world stage. I mean, we're just, as long as it doesn't conflict with our interests. We have a country now, you know, we have an administration now that expresses more or less nothing but contempt for our democratic allies and a very strange admiration for our actual enemies, like, you know, Vladimir Putin. All of that's just bizarre and corrosive. And I think we have horrified much of the free world for good reason, right? I mean, this is just alarming. And there's been a few silver linings. I mean, one is that now Europe is taking more responsibility for its own defense. I think that is a good thing, all things considered. I think that could have been engineered without us destroying our soft power for a generation and just announcing to everyone that we're purely transactional and purely corrupt. And, you know, what you really have to do is pay bakshish to our first family to get what you want from the United States. I mean, all of that's just awful, right? So I think we want all those norms back. We want a sane president in 2028 that can offer a full mea culpa for the last decade, really, and try to find some reset button with the world. I don't know how easy that would be to accomplish, but I think we need a president that will limit the powers of the presidency against his or her seemingly short-term interests in 2028. That's probably too much to hope for. But yeah, those norms were there for a reason, and we wanted more of them. Right, we want to be able to coordinate to solve global problems, and we have taken a massive step back there.
Yeah, I remember when you were talking to Sarah Longwell at the Bulwark, and she had made a comment about the Democrats being able to learn something from Trump in that he just proved that things could get done, and the Democrats shouldn't fight in their other direction. They should take that lesson and get things done on their side. And given the way that Trump's been doing many things, but especially this war, how will you view Trump if he turns out to be the one who finally brings peace to the Middle East, having done it?
Well, again, I certainly hope for that, right? And it's not impossible. I can't say I'm optimistic about that, but you know, I do not want him to fail on this front. I hope that's obvious. And it is true that some of our norms and some of our, you know, kind of slavish devotion to process and multilateralism and everything else has produced friction where we probably didn't want friction, right? I mean, so it's not that there's no silver lining to any of this, you know, norm breaking, but for the most part, I think it's terrifying and demoralizing, right? I just think it's bad. I think Trump has revealed, you know, if we could do a proper postmortem on his two terms, I think we would, you know, 9 times out of 10, we would find that, okay, here's the thing that he broke that we didn't want broken, and we need to figure out how to shore this up so that a president can't break this again. But 10% of the time, I think we might reconsider the norm, right? We might say, okay, you know, his recklessness or his selfishness, his impulsivity, you know, his character flaws revealed something about this norm over here that, you know, we didn't need it in the first place. We didn't want it. And, you know, even a dummy like him got something done that should have been done, should have been easier to do, right? So here were regulations that we really didn't need. And, you know, we shouldn't have had them in the first place, et cetera. I think there are probably honest discoveries of that sort to make. But for the most part, I think what we need to do is restore trust in institutions and processes. And we need to clean house. And I'm very worried that any sort of house cleaning after 2028 is going to look like more hyper-partisanship, and that's going to be a problem.
Are you worried about anti-Semitism on the rise? It seems there are sort of now two camps of Jews, probably could have used a better word for that. One that seeks to avoid the tall poppy syndrome, and the other that says, you know, fuck you, we're not hiding or apologizing anymore.
Right.
Where are you on that? Or how do you feel about all this, and which approach? do you think is in the right direction?
Well, I am increasingly worried about anti-Semitism. It just, you know, is now, you know, fully burgeoning on the left and the right to a degree that I wouldn't have thought possible. And it, what the alarming thing on the right, when you look at how, what the Trump administration does and doesn't do about it and doesn't say about it, is that it clearly Republicans from Trump on down feel like they can't be too clear on this topic, even if they don't share any of these, you know, poisonous views, right? So you're not getting a very clear condemnation of people like Nick Fuentes and Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens, and people who are doing more than dog whistle, but just they're holding open the tent for, you know, white supremacy and anti-Semitism. It's the fact that Trump and J.D. Vance and, you know, everyone who's truly in power can't say, okay, this is awful, we want nothing to do with it. That's, I think, quite alarming. I mean, they clearly think they need the anti-Semitic white supremacist vote on some level. God only knows why, but I mean, you'd think they'd be more worried about alienating independents. So yeah, I am worried about it. I think you might be referring to the talk that Bret Stephens gave at the 92nd Street Y about you know, just his views on how doomed it is to fight anti-Semitism explicitly.
Well, that talk, and then there was a Super Bowl commercial that was sort of on the other side that was very, you know.
I didn't see that. I heard about it, but it sounded terrible, yeah. So, I mean, Bret gave a very thought-provoking talk, which I don't think I agree with in the end. I certainly don't agree with his conclusion. I mean, his conclusion is the only real remedy is to double down on Jewish identity, right? So, like, he seemed to be arguing for a Jewish identity politics that is much more muscular than it has been in the past. Then, needless to say, I'm allergic to that for reasons that I could spell out if anyone's interested. But the first part of his talk, he said, listen, this has failed. There's no way we can successfully fight anti-Semitism by being more philanthropic or being more apologetic or by arguing rationally against various conspiracy theories. We have to just recognize that this is a mind virus for which we don't have an inoculation, and we essentially just have to tell the anti-Semites of the world to go fuck themselves. I mean, he was more eloquent and less scatological than that, but that was his punchline. Just like unapologetic, you know, we're just going to succeed in the face of this hatred, realizing we don't have a remedy for the hatred. Right? We're just going to, you know, our success is going to be our rejoinder to this. And so it is with Israel. Israel's success and its successful defense of itself is going to be its rejoinder to this. I think I agree with that, but I'm, as you know, just very reluctant to endorse anything like a Jewish politics of identity around this. I think we have to fight for Enlightenment values and the values of open societies, right? And that, for me, is a post-racial, post-identity politics future that we have to keep in sight.
I think what's so scary now is that, having grown up experiencing anti-Semitism, you know, it was the David Duke types, or it just always felt like it was in small corners. And today you have unbelievably gifted people from Nick Fuentes to Tucker to Candace who have studios, they can reach the world, and they're really good at what they do. And that makes it a lot for the first time where I have a different feeling about the narrative around Judaism. And then I want to hit a sort of devil's advocate question that just came in.
Okay.
The thing about anti-Semitism is a lot of anti-Semitism is just valid critique of Israel. On this note, what do you think about the obvious power the Israel lobby has on our country's foreign policy?
I don't think it's the Israel lobby that has that power. I think it's the recognition that Israel is our real ally in the region and the one democracy in the region, and that they're fighting a civilizational war for us in many respects, right? I mean, they're really on the front line. Like, for them, Iran with a nuke is a true existential concern, right? Now, it's, you know, you see, it's not an existential concern for the United States. You could argue that even if a nuke went off in Times Square and killed 10 million people, that's not existential for the United States, right? As bad as that would be. Okay, fine. But that's just sort of fine print on a kind of missing the point on the larger conversation, which is, we're at war with jihadism, full stop, right? And that's Israel's problem. Is, you know, you can say whatever you want about Netanyahu, you can say whatever you want about the religious extremists on the right in Israel. They're completely unlike the religious extremists within Islam. You know, we can double click on that claim if you like. You know, as odious as they are, they're not nearly as bad as the jihadists. I just think, you know, Netanyahu, warts and all, is not the real problem here. The real problem is Israel has been trying to live with jihadists, and that's proved totally untenable. There is no two-state solution if that other state is run by jihadists, right? So there's no two-state solution with a democratically elected Hamas government. So until that changes, and that's a cultural change that I think could happen, right? It's in the process of happening in various areas, you know, under Islam, right? It's in the process of happening even in authoritarian contexts, like in Saudi Arabia. I mean, Saudi Arabia, for all of its problems, is sidelining its religious fanatics, you know, to some considerable degree. Again, I'm no fan of MBS, right? I mean, I think he's probably a psychopath and has done awful things. And there's a lot to condemn in Saudi Arabia, but they're doing this one good thing, pulling back the reins on jihadism. And I think that bodes well for the future. I mean, it's a promising sign. So there's a lot to condemn in the Israeli government. And the whole settler movement in the West Bank, awful. You're going to get no defense of it here. I think it's provocative of future violence, present violence and future violence. But the real problem is Israel has been surrounded by people who have explicitly genocidal aims with respect to the Jews there. And we have, for understandable reasons, been their allies. And I think it's, you know, I think open societies everywhere have to recognize that the problem on October 7th was the same problem as, you know, the Bataclan massacre or Charlie Hebdo or anything else that has nothing to do with Israel, the Danish cartoon controversy. I mean, this kind of stuff is going to keep happening at every scale. And it's not happening because we're meddling in the Middle East. It's happening because there is a zero-sum conflict between jihadism and the values of open societies. And historically, no one has suffered this conflict more than Muslims themselves. And that's still true in the aggregate. But, you know, occasionally we suffer considerable pain and we react to it in a piecemeal way. I just think we should never lose sight of this. Jihadism is a deal breaker.
Yeah, and also when people think about religious maniacs on both sides, these are not the same numbers, not even close.
No, they're not the same.
Most people don't know.
They don't have the same beliefs. They don't have the same influence over their cultures. They don't have the same kind of support from people who are not themselves militants, right? It's just, if there were an analogous death cult in Israel, you know, among Jews, I would condemn it in precisely the way I'm condemning the death cult of jihadism in the context of, you know, Hamas and Gaza. That's just not the situation, right? As much as, I mean, again, the religious fanatics among Jews are despicable, and I think they should not be in power and they should not be collaborated with, right? So it's just, they are definitely a problem. And optically, they manage to, they're enough of a problem that they manage to confuse the issue for more or less everybody. And they think that, okay, they're fanatics on both sides. So there's kind of some kind of moral parity here, but that's just not the case.
Again, but the number, I know the differences, but the numbers, we're talking about maybe, you know, less than a million max on the Jewish side. And I don't know how many on Islam, but it's a lot more than that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it's also just a completely different commitment. I mean, this, again, I've said this many times, but I do think this distills the issue for Israel. At any point in the last 80 years, if the Palestinians had laid down their weapons and said, okay, we just want to live in peace here, that peace could have been accomplished, right? If the Israelis had laid down their weapons at any point in the last 80 years and said, okay, we just want to live in peace here, there would have been a genocide. If you think that's an exaggeration, I think you're completely out of touch with the culture on the Palestinian side. And so whether you agree with that or not, that is the thing that explains my position here, because I am quite certain that that is the case.
I'm going to shift topics.
Are we going to talk about Tucker's interview with Huckabee? Because I think that this connects to the anti-Semitism question.
Let's get into it right now.
Okay. I mean, I thought that was fascinating and well worth watching. And the thing that was both interesting and alarming from my point of view there is that Tucker clearly believes, and I have every reason to think he's right to believe this, is that he has an audience that it was prepared for him to put a lot of daylight between him and his Christianity and, you know, plain vanilla evangelical Christianity around these issues. I mean, so the way he went after Huckabee based on a differentiation between the New Testament and the Old Testament. I mean, he walked Huckabee into the Old Testament. So explicitly with respect to, I think it was Genesis 15 and a claim that the God gave the Jews all the land between the Euphrates and the Nile, you know, pretty much all of the Middle East. And he just, you know, with his incredulous shtick, he said, you mean to tell me you'd be okay with Israel conquering all that land, you know, conquering Syria and Lebanon and Iraq? And Huckabee, you know, tried to pirouette saying, you know, well, Israel's not asking for that. But Tucker knew that he was going to have to sign on the dotted line for on the biblical mandate. And Huckabee did. He said, yeah, if they, you know, but if they did it, you know, I couldn't say anything, you know, I couldn't object. It's in the Bible, right? And so he's gotten vilified for that. But what was interesting about that is that Tucker seemed to be expressing a theology, and perhaps there's a name for this that I'm just not aware of, that draws a very clear line of demarcation between the Old and the New Testament in a way that is, you know, I've heard it's been drawn before, and even in Huckabee's style of Christianity, but he's basically saying, listen, we're Christians. We don't have to care about the Old Testament at all, right? There's just a lot of barbarism in there. He went after the whole Amalekite business, you know, that's just genocide, right? Like, listen, we don't need to defend these Jews at all. Their holy book is irrelevant to us. It's just barbarism in there. Christ is king. All we have to care about is Jesus, and we can just wash our hands of the Jews, right? And then, you know, implicit in all of that is, you know, we know the Jews just killed Jesus, and fuck them, right? It's like, and so he put Huckabee and all of evangelical Christianity in very difficult position with respect to his audience, which I'm amazed to find that it exists, which is, you know, Christians prepared to say all of this traditional support for Israel and kind of a veneration of the Old Testament even is behind us, right? There's just this kind of America first, Christ is king, fuck the Jews politics. And so I found that pretty interesting and surprising. I hadn't seen that done before.
Yeah. And I think when Huckabee, just to add, said, you know, he would support Israel taking over that land, I think 90% of all Jews gasped at that, especially Israeli Jews. Were, yeah. Wait, what?
Yeah, yeah.
That's not us. A question from the subscribers that just came into the chat. Why have you pulled your punches when it comes to Megyn Kelly, but not Tucker? I can't stand either. Just curious.
So in explanation of that, I just have to say, I never watch Megyn Kelly's stuff. So I mean, there's a lot I haven't seen. I just hear rumors of how she's unraveled. I guess I've seen a couple of clips, but not recently. So I don't know how bad she's gotten, but I, you know, appreciate that she's doesn't appear to be the Megyn Kelly I thought I had met when I was on her podcast. So yeah, I think I probably do condemn what she's up to now as much as you would want me to. I just haven't seen it. And I consider Tucker to be much more influential and a much, I mean, just kind of a much darker presence in our politics, right? Like, I think Tucker could probably run for office if he wanted to. I think, I mean,
you don't think Megyn could run for office?
No, not in the same way. I mean, I think Tucker could actually run for president and probably get the nomination. I mean, I think that's how scary things are. And I think Tucker gets called into the White House to meet the president regularly, and he's close with J.D. Vance. I mean, he's just closer to power than I know Megyn to be. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about Megyn, but I just hadn't heard any of that. So. Yeah. So yeah,
I'm not pulling any punches.
I'm kind of oblivious to what she's doing.
All right, I'm going to switch topics. There were a lot of questions about feeling hopeless and looking for direction from you. There just seems to be this feeling of, you know, what's going to kill us first, war, AI, our own government, or our own anxiety and stress. So this next segment, I'm going to try to address some of those questions. I just feel like that it's a little perplexing. It feels like with modernity, we're in 2026 and we should be much closer to living much better. And for some reason, history keeps creeping in ways that are perplexing. All right, so here's the first question. Huge fan and hellos from Paris. There's so much happening and it's hard to escape from thousands of doomsday predictions of World War III and apocalypse and whatnot. What should one pay attention to or ignore in these troubled times? And how do you stay mindful in these circumstances?
Well, I mean, it's... I think I've talked about this before on the podcast. I mean, it is a sort of strange paradox because I spend my time both professionally and just as a matter of my own, you know, weird, you know, masochistic interest, paying attention to all the bad things that are happening. I mean, I spend much more time thinking about the bad things than the good things, right? I'm a glasses half empty guy.
Glasses gone.
Yeah, the glass is broken, and we wish it was half empty much of the time. And yet, I have a very high level of, you know, life satisfaction and it just, you know, well-being in my life now. I feel incredibly lucky, and you know, I've got great relationships, and it's just you know, there's nothing necessarily paradoxical about that, but in terms of, you know, if you could sort of experience sample from my mind stream, you'd see me, like, you know, pay attention to the scary thing in the news, and then, you know, look out the window and see how beautiful the clouds are passing through the sky, right? I mean, it's like those things are not in conflict. I think we all, I mean, whatever you think may or may not happen after death, the only thing you can be sure of is you've got this one life. And I think you should try to solve the riddle of happiness as completely as you can, and, you know, personally, and discover that loving people around you and overcoming the obstacles to feeling that love more and more of the time, I mean, all of that is necessary to do and available to do whatever is happening in the world. And yet there is some connection, there should be some connection between private happiness and public responsibility, right? So that it's like, it would feel irresponsible for me to just figure out how to fully inure myself against the news and to be, you know, privately happy and oblivious to what's happening in the world, and to do absolutely nothing, to contribute absolutely nothing other than my own, you know, well-being to making the future more sane for my daughters and, you know, your kids than it would otherwise be. And so I think we all have a responsibility to be engaged politically and to be aware of what's happening and to try to add, you know, signal rather than noise to the situation. But we don't actually have to be miserable while doing that. You have to kind of work on two levels. I think you need to figure out if there's anything you can do to help the world. And if there isn't, well, then, you know, relax and you might as well be happy. If there is, okay, still, you might as well be happy, right? So it's like, I mean, we're all going to die, right? Like, it's not everything ultimately, you know, personally speaking, again, whatever you think happens after death, we're all going to lose everything we gather in this place eventually, right? So this is, it's all rented, it's all temporary. We should enjoy whatever is here to be enjoyed. And, you know, one of the things that's here, and I think one of the real foundations of well-being, is compassion and is love for other people, even people we haven't met. And so we want to participate in making the world better than it is, and making the future better, or at least not worse than the past. So yeah, I don't see a contradiction there. But I just think it's important not to become morbid just by scrolling, you know, doom scrolling and watching the news and feeling like everything is awful. I mean, that's just, that's not helping you. It's not helping the world. It's not, I mean, you need, if that's what the news does to you, you need to figure out how to step back and create a more durable foundation for your own well-being before you start joining the fray here.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to be talking about it over and over again, because I think it's less of a contradiction and more of a balance that one's trying to strike. How do you stay informed without going crazy?
Yeah.
And for someone like you, you spent many, many years developing a practice that's almost like the ability to instantly activate some form of armor where you can read the news and then, you know, do both things at the same time, walk into the living room and hug your daughters or look out the window and enjoy life. And I think that something that I've had to work on, and I'm sure many others who have learned from the app, is to figure out how do you make those transitions in life where you leave, you know, work at the door, you come in and you're able to activate your best self or access your best self and remind yourself that there are wonderful things right here in front of you. Again, your example of looking out the window or living in a house or thinking about all the things that you have, I'm much more optimistic than you are. And I still find it hard. And I think many in the audience, again, with this feeling, it feels like you're under the weight of a boulder right now with it almost at every turn, something is coming for you. And I just wonder how much or what percentage you think of the enemy is coming from outside versus, you know, inside, right? Our heads. And if even without many of these concerns, whether it's AI or war, we're dealing with that anyway, it just feels like it's a lot worse. I think, you know, just before I let you answer this, I've heard you say in the past, it's much better to have a mindfulness practice before you need it than when you're, you know, freaking out and in hysterics. So it might help us understand maybe how to make that transition better, because again, a lot of the questions seem to deal with anxiety of the moment and how to find equanimity and, you know, again, keep the news in view and find peace.
Well, I do think, again, it's boring for me to keep coming back to this, but honestly, it was such a grotesque discovery that I just, I mean, for as long as I live, I'll keep coming back to it. you know, getting off of social media was just the biggest life hack in the last, you know, quarter century in my life. I mean, yes, mindfulness is important, and it's true that, you know, I spent a lot of time watching my mind and developing a capacity to just kind of let go of suffering. But it also matters sort of what you do with your attention by default, hour by hour. And my time on social media was just really corrosive in a way that it took me a very long time to recognize, and getting off of it was transformative, right? It's not that I never look at it. I mean, occasionally, you know, you and other people send me links to look at, and, you know, sometimes it's necessary to keep me in touch with what's going on in the world. And sometimes social media is the best place to see the thing that just happened. But to be on it a lot and to have your reputation, I mean, if you have any kind of public facing life, to have your reputation on it in a way that you care about, right? And to be monitoring all of that, I mean, it's just so god awful. And I really think that, I don't think the jury's out on this anymore, but at some point we're going to recognize that we did something awful to ourselves with social media. I mean, we basically set our culture on fire and set our politics on fire. And, you know, we wouldn't have a President Trump or anything like a President Trump. I think it's unimaginable without social media. So much of what ails us now is a story of what we're doing to ourselves moment by moment with this hallucination machine. And there's some very bad actors there who, you know, I've named many times before, and they have all the leverage they have because everyone is just staring into this grotesque funhouse mirror. And, you know, all of the journalists, all of the politicians, all of the academics, and they can't break away. And so we have to transform our relationship to this technology. And until we do that, it's going to keep polluting our minds. Especially, it's telling us, it's making us worse because it's convincing us, it's showing us the worst side of everyone and making those impressions indelible. And we react to those impressions, and the extremes amplify one another. And it's just, whereas we once had partisanship, now we have a kind of hyper-partisanship that is impossible to reason with. So anyway, I think it's, you have to pay attention to what you're feeding your mind, right? I mean, you on some level, you become what you pay attention to moment to moment. And that's just, to become more sensitive to that is probably the first principle of maintaining or reclaiming your sanity.
Well, there's a popular idea that has been going around the internet for a while, and I'm sure it's based in reality somewhere, that you become the sum of the five people you spend the most time with. And I'm sure a lot of people fill those five spots, or some of those five spots, with random strangers or people that are
Tucker
just
Carlson,
piping
yeah.
in, yeah, in yeah. negative shit in their brains. I do want to vouch for you getting off social media. I can tell you, it made my life 30% better with you getting off.
Yeah.
And it's funny too, that we experienced this a few times where I think we were on a trip somewhere, or nobody was paying attention. And then we noticed 3 days later, you were just getting absolutely destroyed and canceled.
Right.
And it's as though it's never happened. We're like, oh, hey, wait, like nobody informed us. We just missed it. We didn't see it, and nothing happened. Like you didn't see it anywhere. So it is
if I don't know how long ago this was, but you showed me this clip of, you know, when I was on Cenk Uygur's podcast 10 years ago, and I said,
crazy.
I was making the point that a style of speaking within a philosophy seminar is something that you can't do out in public, and certainly not in your politics, right? Because it's like the context matters. Like in a philosophy seminar, you could say, you know, if you're trying to drill down on the foundations of ethics, you could say, you know, why can't you eat babies, right? People are hungry. They're unwanted babies. Babies have a lot of protein in them. Why? Just tell me, give me an argument. Why can't you ever eat, you know, babies? Okay, that's in a philosophy seminar. That's totally fine. You hear that kind of thing said all the time. Out in the world, you sound like a total psychopath. And then I made the additional point on that podcast, which is that, you know, that we're living in an environment now that is so disingenuous and so partisan that someone will clip me saying that out of context to make it seem like I'm a psychopath who can't figure out why we can't eat babies, right? Which is exactly what happened. Now, you know, maybe it happened at the time, but it happened 10 years later, and now it's linked to somehow the Epstein case, and that was bouncing around social media. And, you know, one guy had it on his feed on Instagram, and I think I was getting, you know, death threats or quasi-death threats as a result of his promoting all that. And yet, none of this, I mean, honestly, like, I just took longer to explain that than it occupied space in my brain when you showed it to me. I mean, obviously, death. You know, I'm not cavalier about death threats, but still, it's just, this is again, it's just a hallucination machine. Well,
Well, that situation, so that situation did land on my desk and I did see it and I got a lot of notifications about it from people. That was scary because there was a guy in the video who was a chef with a like a knife and sort of a call to action to go and, you know, handle these people. And a lot of the death threats that were coming in were based on that video saying knife-related things that were very uncomfortable. And to his credit, we did reach out to him and asked him to take it down. You know, I happened to go to his channel and see that there were many sane and normal people that I knew following him. So I had to assume that he didn't do it on purpose. It's not a good video. Right. Well, but I mean, we reached out and he took it down.
Yeah, well, that's great. But I mean, the larger point is when you see a clip of somebody saying something insane, especially, I mean, a relatively normal, I mean, I guess if you see a, you know, you understand, I mean, the truth is this applies even to Trump, right? I mean, like Trump has been clipped out of context in ways that are completely defamatory and not at all helpful, right? So it's just true across the board. It's like we are living and dying by clips now, right? We are just destroying our culture with what we are doing with clips. I mean, the number of times I've seen someone react to something that I did not say, but only seemed to say because of how something was clipped on social media. I mean, it's just the biggest, it's just pure toxic waste, you know, and it's spread around everywhere.
That's on a continuum there because you have people like Elon Musk who are believing it, who are just too lazy to, he's not dumb, obviously, he just has no time to look at that and get the full context.
But the truth is, what's worse now is that people don't even care. Like someone like Elon just simply doesn't care because when you point it out to him, his response isn't, oh, sorry, I didn't, you know, I should have checked the context. No, it's his response is, go fuck yourself, right? So people just want to smear other people who they've decided they're the enemy, right? So, and they're using clips to do that. And it's just a terrible practice. But what I'm saying is that as consumers of information, we should understand, everyone should understand that we are being inundated with these half-truths and outright lies in clip form. Right, where you're, and leaving aside deep fakes and everything else that is going to be confusing, I mean, this willingness to have your view of a person or an issue completely decided by a 45-second clip is a habit we have to break, right? It's just shattering us.
Well, on the other side of the continuum that I was getting to are just a lot of dummies who don't see that clip and say, hey, wait a second, maybe this is taken out of context, maybe there's more. And unfortunately, we have to just admit that there are a lot of people out there that are not very bright. I want to ask you, related to all of this and the helplessness and the feelings of that people are going through, what role do you think psychedelics should play in all of this? Especially with the transition and the anxiety around. I mean, there's so much anxiety. It just feels like a nice burst of psychedelics could
settle. I think a judicious one, right? I think people need to be careful with psychedelics. We should be clear that word can be misleading, right? It doesn't necessarily name a coherent class of drug. I mean, your experience on mushrooms may not be the same as your experience on LSD, and it's certainly not going to be the same as your experience on MDMA, which isn't even technically a psychedelic, right? So to say nothing of ketamine, I mean, these drugs are all different. And I think there are people who shouldn't take any of them, very likely. I'm not as concerned about MDMA as for some people than I am proper psychedelics. But I just think we risk running headlong into a new overuse and kind of recklessness that really brought down the curtain on the 60s. I think we need to be careful. These are very powerful drugs. And it's possible to have a terrifying and destabilizing experience on many of them. But the other side is that many of them show immense therapeutic potential, and they've been indispensable for many of us in seeing corners of the mind that we weren't otherwise going to see and being inspired to look more closely at the nature of the mind directly through other methods like meditation. I mean, there's no way I would have gotten into meditation or persisted very far without some initial experiences on psychedelics and drugs like MDMA. So they were indispensable. I can't deny that they were indispensable to me, but I can see that simply taking more drugs is a bad path for many people.
Right, but I understand the need to have these experiences responsibly, but you don't think that the benefit of getting these drugs in the right hands outweighs the downsides of getting them in the wrong ones? I mean, you were able to have the exposure and then decide to get off the ride. I'd imagine the majority of people could benefit from these. And, okay. Yeah. You know, all right, you come with all sorts of
I'll give you an example that's ready to hand. So Someone gave me some mushroom chocolates not that long ago. And the other day I decided...
I'll need to commission that.
Yeah, I hadn't microdosed in quite some time. And I decided to just nibble one of these chocolates, not knowing what the, you know, really just not knowing what the dose, just ballparking it. Not a whole square, but part of a square. And I thought, okay, this is going to be something like a microdose and what could go wrong? And I wound up having a pretty intense, you know, mushroom experience, you know, first thing in the morning on whatever it was, a Tuesday, when I was, you know, planning on just, essentially the psychedelic version of a strong cup of coffee. And it didn't turn bad for me because I know what to do with that, right? Like I've been around this track enough and, you know, it turned into some pretty profound meditation for me. But for somebody else, I mean, they could have wound up in the ER, right? Like it's like
But that's a solvable problem. We could just get the right doses. Get this in the right hands. Yeah,
judiciousness is what I, you know, how I framed it. I mean, I just think there's no question that some people can be tipped into, you know, what would be properly thought of as psychosis with psychedelics. Now, whether they were going to become psychotic anyway, I don't know. But you know, I've certainly experienced what I think of as psychosis on psychedelics, and happily, that, like many other things, proved to be impermanent. But
I find myself bumping into people all the time, just thinking, God, they would benefit from this. I'm sure I bump into some people, and I say, not for you, but for the vast majority of people,
it's hard to know. I mean, it's hard to know from the outside. It's even hard to know from the inside, right? You don't know what you're going to experience when you do psychedelics for the first time, and you don't know what you're going to experience when you do them for the 10th time or the 100th time. I mean, really, you can be a battle-hardened psychonaut, and your next mushroom trip could just leave you prostrate in agony, right? Like you don't know. So it's just, again, this is just, it's hard to give a pat story here, but I agree with you that MDMA, real MDMA, I mean, who knows what you're getting on the street, but if you get real MDMA and you don't take too much of it, you know, most people are going to have a very positive experience. Not everyone, but certainly most people, and it can be incredibly therapeutic.
Yeah. So I'm really more talking about where I think society should be headed, not what I'm, you know, not passing on advice that people should do this on their own.
That's why we want more research and more. I mean, we don't want to behave in ways that bring another war on drugs upon us. I mean, that will be awful.
All right. And now it's time for the lightning round. So we have a lot of questions in here. We're going to try to get to them. So try to keep it tight-ish. Mm. All right. Any thoughts on Anthropic versus the DOD and Sam Altman sliding into Hegseth's DMs and making a deal moments later?
Just that it seems like Dario seems like the most ethical and careful of the people who are developing this technology, right? And so I think their stance was understandable, and the fact that they didn't want their models used for mass surveillance of Americans or premature development of fully autonomous weapons, I mean that seems totally sane. And the fact that the Department of Defense got a different deal from OpenAI or seems to have, you know, that's concerning. Again, we're in an arms race that we really should want to get out of, but I'm not quite sure how we're going to get out of it.
What are your thoughts on prediction markets drawing any lines when it comes to things that should maybe be off limits? For example, you can now bet when the first nuclear bomb will detonate. That seems terrifying. Thoughts?
Well, this is a sort of a story of trade-offs. I mean, I think it's interesting to see the wisdom of crowds insofar as it's on display here. I mean, these betting markets, as far as I know, are better predictors of what is likely to happen than actual experts. I could have that wrong, but that's what I think is still true. But, you know, the idea of insider trading with respect to nuclear war is a little scary, or anything like nuclear war. The fact that someone's in a position to know a decision's being made and to bet on that, I mean, that's just obviously corrupt. And we should try to catch those people, right? You know, whoever makes $5 million or whatever it is betting on, you know, whether we're going to bomb a country, you know, if that person is a friend of Pete Hegseth, you know, that we should investigate all that. So,
or is placing a bet for Pete Hegseth?
I mean, I'm less worried about that being consequential, right? Like, I don't think a war is going to start because someone knows they can make some money betting that a war is going to start. I mean, I think that's less of a concern, but yeah, it's pretty dystopian. I mean, if you put this in a movie, it would seem implausible somehow.
Sam recently mentioned some right of center podcasts he listens to but doesn't always agree with, like The Bulwark and Commentary Magazine. Which left of center podcasts does he listen to, if any?
Well, occasionally I listen to Ezra Klein occasionally when he's got a guest or a topic that I want to hear. Occasionally I'll listen to Positive America guys on something, again, kind of guest or topic dependent. I know there are others, but...
You ever catch any Gavin Newsom's podcast?
Yeah, just a couple episodes, yeah. But not regularly. I'm blanking on some, but...
All right, we can come back to
that. Yeah, I know there are others, but I tend to want to hear... I mean, my news diet is pretty left of center. I mean, it's the New York Times, it's the Atlantic, right? So I'm getting the... I mean, it's center too, but it's also left, you know, left-leaning view of virtually everything, you know, insofar as it's slanted to the left. And so I have a couple of podcasts that just keep me a little more tuned to the right-sided view of things. Again, not MAGA, but again, I occasionally watch something crazy, like I'll watch Tucker, you know, with Huckabee for nearly 3 hours just to see what's happening there, so.
There's a meme of Sam Harris with a quote from the Within Reason podcast, and it's been circulating that Sam fundamentally disagrees with his wife, Annika, with respect to philosophy of mind. Could Sam clarify where there may be any daylight that exists between the two, as well as the idea that consciousness could be a fundamental part of reality? Is there any daylight between you guys, or maybe you could just take that part of it? Where do you guys disagree?
It's more a matter of interest. I don't think we disagree about it. It's just... She's much more interested in the conversation around panpsychism, for lack of a better word. I mean, she hates that word, and I understand why, but it captures this whole area of speculation around just how deeply consciousness might reach into the physics of things, and maybe it goes all the way down. Maybe consciousness is, you know, a fundamental property of the universe, which is to say it's not an emergent property of information processing or anything else at a higher level. For some reason, the way I explain it to myself is I think it's probably unfalsifiable, and, you know, I wouldn't expect the universe to be different if that were true. And I'm not sure what, I mean, if it's not unfalsifiable, I just not clear to me what predictions follow from it. So it's just more, I find myself just not really interested in that piece of the question. I mean, we have, I think, the same view of the hard problem of consciousness, and we're similarly... unimpressed by the kind of classic efforts in the philosophy of mind or in the sciences of mind to just kind of blast past the hard problem and just declare that, no, we know that consciousness is an emergent property of, you know, brain processes, and it's going to be easy to explain it once we find the neural correlates of consciousness in the brain, et cetera. I think we view more or less all of that the same. I mean, so like she and I disagree with someone like Dan Dennett on questions of this sort to the same degree and for the same reasons.
Can you please interview Michael Pollan, which is related to this, as a podcast guest on his new book, A World Appears? I can't imagine a better conversation than Harris and Pollan talking about consciousness.
Yeah, I think we have that
scheduled.
I think it's coming up, yeah.
Anything that you, any daylight you might have with him, or just...
I haven't read his book yet, so okay. I'm interested to read it before we talk.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah. I think that'll be great. UK listener here, where the nominally environmental political party, the Green Party, have just won a significant local election by running on largely anti-Israel, anti-West ticket in alliance with Muslim activists. This seems to be the trajectory of many involved in the climate change movement, has led me to wonder whether the claims around the environment are equally captured by political zealotry, to the point where I now doubt we are in fact in the midst of climate emergency. Has Sam's views on the climate altered in any way in recent years?
I don't know if they've... I'm worried about that same political dynamic. I'm worried that there's a leftist, far left alliance with Islamism simply for, you know, purely pragmatic reasons, right? I mean, in many of these countries, pooling those votes together can be decisive. I don't think that is going to bode well for open societies, right? So it's, you know, the left here are the useful idiots, and the Islamists are well aware of what they're accomplishing. And if that sounds like a conspiracy theory, it shouldn't. I mean, all of this has been explicitly said out in the open for years now. Yeah, my thoughts about climate change are simply that virtually no one has the bandwidth to even think about it now, which is a measure of how much else there is to worry about, you know, in the last 10 years. I mean, something happened in the last decade between Trump and COVID and October 7th. And I mean, there's just too much news. The forces of history and chaos. Again, I think social media has a lot to do with this. The noise got turned up so loud that it has crowded out any kind of slow moving problem like climate change to a degree that I think we could live to regret. But it's just, add AI to this picture, right? Everything, you have all of these fast moving objects that are capturing our attention for obvious reasons. The slow moving thing is just can't be made salient. And so I don't know what, I don't think my views about it have changed, but I just noticed that it's just, I don't have the bandwidth to think about it. And I can't imagine more than a few dozen climate scientists do at this moment.
Right. Well, and forget about the funding for any of that. A lot of questions in the chat about Ben Shapiro coming on. We were supposed to have him on, I think, a few weeks ago, but it got rescheduled April 22nd. So we'll be having him on.
Something happened with his schedule, but I think it's going to happen.
Right. Yeah. Any thoughts on voter system improvements like ranked choice voting?
Yeah. I haven't gone deep on that. I mean, it seems that would be a good change, and also a change to our primary process would be good. There are people who have thought about that. I mean, I think Andrew Yang has kind of obsessed on that in recent years, and there are others. Yeah, I mean, clearly we have a system that is selecting for radicals at the primary level who then become way too polarizing in the general election, and it's just none of that's good, right? So it would be great to figure out how to re-engineer the incentives here, and ranked choice voting and open primaries might be, be the low-hanging fruit.
How should we orient ourselves when raising children in a stable family? This is sort of harkens back to the subjects we were talking about before, but how should we orient ourselves when raising children in a stable family in what seems like a particularly chaotic and precarious time in history? It feels like due to this problem, whether it's a mirage generated by social media or not, many are simply foregoing having children altogether. How can we proceed through this? I've heard this a lot from people, that a lot of people just are afraid to have kids now.
Hmm. I'm not really in touch with this phenomenon, if it is a phenomenon. I guess I'm skeptical that there are many people who are deciding not to have kids because of some kind of macroscopic analysis of life on Earth, right? So I've been hearing this for years that Gen Z doesn't want to have kids because of climate change or whatever. But I think people probably have other reasons that they don't want to have kids, and they might be telling themselves a story that it's because of the state of the world, but it might be the state of their lives, right? It might be they might have economic reasons, they have relationship reasons.
You don't think those are the same? The state of the world is the state of their minds. I mean, I understand we just talked about a distinction between
climate change. Like if you can't get a job, that's a more pressing reason than your views on the species being doomed because of existential risk or climate change or the World War III or something like that. I mean, I think it's, again, I don't know what research exists on this, but I would be skeptical that many people are making that life decision on the basis of reading the news, right? I mean, I get, yes, if you can't afford a house, if you can't find a job, obviously, if you can't find a relationship, right? If you're dating using, Tinder and you're experiencing nothing but awfulness there, right? Like, so yes, there are closer to hand reasons why you might not see a clear path to parenthood. But judging, extrapolating from the news to that life decision, I think that's not the most common thing. I mean, again, that's just my intuition, but
yeah, I think we're going to have to get somebody younger on here. I think we sound like a couple of boomers trying
possible. Yeah. But, I mean, no, but there are other, again, the closer to hand reasons are, there are reasons to worry about starting out in this world now, right? With respect to careers and, so, yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'd like to hear from somebody in that age group, what they're going through. Here's a question. Will the Truth and Consequences tour, which sounds like a WWE event, be coming to the UK? Actually kind of sounds like a good war name too. I don't know. Maybe I should answer that.
I don't know. So we haven't talked about it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
All right. Well, that's it. How'd you feel?
All right. Yeah. Well, that's good, right? That was fun.
Okay.
Thanks again for everyone coming out. Brings different energy to these conversations. And will you tell us if it was worthwhile. We'll do it again if so.
I want to thank everyone who submitted questions. If you'd like to help with the show in the future, you can head over to Sam's page on Substack, submit questions, and participate in the online community. And I think, yeah, we should probably try another one of these again in the future.
Yeah.
So that's it for today's episode. Yeah. Take care.
Thanks, everybody.